Good morning. Thank you for the invitation. I feel like Oscar Wilde said during an exam at Oxford, like a poor Daniel among a bunch of lions. My name is Alberto Manguel. I'm the director of the National Library of Argentina. I've been the director for the past 2 years, and I'm not a librarian, so I accepted under false pretenses. I realize after 2 years that my entire job is to try and help librarians do the real work. I'm trying my best, but an institution like the National Library is daily confronted with a huge amount of obstacles that you know better than anyone else, but then that in a country such as Argentina are multiplied by 1,000. When I accepted the position, I imagined that I could apply certain ideas to the running of a library, ideas that I had developed over the past few decades in different books. I felt like somebody who has been writing cooking recipes for ages and finds himself for the first time in the kitchen. I believed, and I still believe, in what Susan defined as a social space, the library as a social space, a forum. Dan Cohen spoke about the same idea when he spoke of political and social project. I believe that the library is that, among other things. Every human act is a political act, and by political, I don't mean sectarian, which was the characteristic of the National Library of Argentina for a number of years. Unfortunately, the position is seen as a political position, and I've tried my best to distance myself from any political party. That is not to say that our activity is not political. It is, of course. For instance, we've taken several decisions that must be seen as political decisions. For instance, when President Putin closed down the Ukrainian library in Moscow and put in prison the director of that library, we immediately opened a Ukrainian library in the National Library of Argentina. So we understand that no act of censorship, such as the one Putin committed, can go unanswered. And our reaction was to set up a Ukrainian library in Argentina because Argentina has a Ukrainian community, but simply because a library, especially a national library, has to be universal and respond to such acts of barbarism. It was important for us to politically understand the National Library not as a library of Buenos Aires, where it physically stands, but as a library of the rest of the country and also international, and also, and especially this, representing the different communities of which Jeanette Bastien so eloquently spoke. So, for instance, a hidden corner, one of the many hidden corners of the library, was the section for the blind. They received blind high school students and helped them with their studies. They received older people who had lost their sight and wanted still to read and be aware of the news. And so, for instance, we gave actually a medal to the oldest reader at the library, a woman who had been coming to the library for decades, and we gave her the medal on the 103rd birthday. She said that she came to the library three times a week because she needed to be aware of the latest news. She was absolutely right. David Ferreiro said, I don't remember who the quote is by, that the three main acts of faith of a library should be a belief in the past, a belief in the future, and a belief that in the present we can make use of the learning of the past in order to build our own future. I think that encapsulates the mission of the library. This is a mission of justice, of social justice. The idea that Robert Darnton spoke about, that everyone should have access to the experience of the past, that what we have done and what we have thought about and what we have written about should be for everyone. Don Quixote tells Sancho that to change the world is neither a utopia nor an act of madness. It's simply justice. And I think that the function of the library can be that. Now, saying that, I'm very much aware of a number of stumbling blocks and difficulties. I'm going to look at the time so that Susan doesn't bring out the big stick. Robert Darnton's ambitious project, the Americana, of trying to bring together all the digital libraries in America. We are trying to do something similar in South America and Spain, collect the digital libraries of the Spanish-speaking world. It's a very old ambition. It's the ambition of Alexandria to have everything. Now, collecting everything for Alexandria, for the little we know, Alexandria had probably clay tablets, had certainly papyrus scrolls, perhaps parchment, stone on which texts were inscribed, maps, objects. A library has never been the exclusive repository of books alone. Every technology needs to be represented in a library. This is obvious, and you know that. But what a digital library allows for is to collect these objects in a much more shareable strategy. Now, again, this is an old ambition. There is a wonderful book that was written in the 3rd century, but there are versions all the way up to the 9th century called The Life of Adam and Eve. And it's a postmodern book because at the end of the book, where the lives of Adam and Eve have been chronicled, it is Eve that speaks to her son, Seth, and says to Seth, now you will write the lives of your parents, which is the book that we have just read. That's the postmodernist twist. And she says to him, you will write it both on clay and on bark, because if the Lord has the world end in water, the bark will survive, and if it ends in fire, the clay will survive. We need to preserve our texts in every technology available, clay and bark and all the other stuff that we have now. And of course, we have to collect material from what Janet described as the different communities. Now, I have a bone to pick with Janet about that, because I don't know how we define these communities. At least my experience in Canada, and then in Argentina, then in France, has been that communities are largely defined from outside. There is some kind of racist impulse to define those who are not you as a community. It's much easier. In Canada, multicultural society, Toronto has neighborhoods that are the Greek neighborhood or the Portuguese neighborhood. And in the effort that Canadians, with the best will in the world, make to allow foreigners who come and claim to be Canadian to continue with their traditions, they label them as, for instance, South American. So I, as an Argentinian, but having lived abroad forever, was expected more or less to put on a Mexican hat and the Chilean poncho and enjoy Mexican food, which I don't. So there is a danger. So what do we call communities? I think that if we allow for a great elasticity and apply something like the mathematical theory of groups, where the circles overlap, and I can belong at the same time to some part of the Argentinian community, not all. I don't identify with many of the political groups. I don't identify with certain Argentinian communities. But if I am allowed to take part of some section of that so-called community, at least the cultural one, or the gay community, or the community of people having lived abroad for a very long time, I allow for those. I'm trying to set up at the National Library of Argentina collections for communities, and here I go again, that are not fairly represented or not represented at all. For instance, the native communities, the history of feminism in Argentina, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual communities. So we're trying to get material from these sections of society, but we have to be enormously careful not to impose our definition of the label. For instance, I have not yet been able to find someone to organize the native community material, because first of all, there are many indigenous communities in Argentina. There are political rifts among them. There are different identities within one community, the Mapuches, for instance, that have now a very strong political presence in Argentina. So how do you go about it? I have been speaking to Canadian and Australian librarians who have material that they give back to the community so that they give them back in digital form, and the communities label them and send them back and saying, this is not a cup, this is a ritual vase. This can be shown, this can only be shown to people from this family or tribe, etc. But I have not managed to see how we can organize what would be a native collection or various native collections. So we need what Dan Cohen called permeability. I think that's a very useful term. I don't know how we can put it in practice, but perhaps speaking to some of you, I can learn more. Now, again, going back to Robert Darnton's idea of collecting everything for everyone, this is what the Alexandrian kings wanted to do. They didn't manage, obviously, to collect everything, and their purpose was, as Darnton pointed out, their prestige. You were as powerful as what you had collected. The problem is, as we find out constantly at the National Library, that there is always something missing. I remember that G.K. Chesterton, talking about book reviewers, said that there's always a reviewer who will review Martin Chuzzlewit and say, well, it's a fairly good novel. Unfortunately, it sheds no light on the marital customs in Norway. there's always something missing. And then we come to the greater problem. We collect what we can, we keep on collecting. In 2015, in the previous administration, about 10,000 items entered the National Library. In the first year of this administration, 100,000 entered the library, and in what has passed in this year, almost 200,000. So we are increasing at an incredible rate. I don't know what to do with the bottleneck in inventory and catalog, and we need more catalogers. If any of you want to come and work at the National Library, you're welcome. We have no money. What happens with all this material? How do you access readers? How do you let the common readers, the readers who commonly come to the library, know what you have? How do you get readers who never come to the library use that material? And the most important question of all, how do you get readers, people who are not yet readers, to read? Christopher Riggs raised a truly important point. We can provide access, and that is not enough. John Rawls makes a useful distinction between freedom and freedom's worth. It's one thing to tell everyone that you're free, but if you don't have a salary, if you don't have a job, if you don't have access to healthcare, if you don't have food, if you don't have housing, then you're not free, or at least that freedom is totally worthless. And in Argentina, this is true of the majority of the population who are struggling to put bread on the table, and literally, I mean bread. I'm convinced that reading can open the world for us. I'm convinced that a reader has more tools to survive in the world than someone who can't read. And I'm convinced that anyone can become a reader. But how do you go from the fulfilling of basic vital needs to opening those doors? I'm not convinced by Brecht's first comes the food, then come the morals. they have to come at the same time, because if there are no morals, you will kill one another at the trough. I think that, I want to believe that the National Library can provide a source for a sort of civic education to teach people what it means to be a citizen, what are their responsibilities and rights, and more importantly, how to go about obtaining those rights, the effective rights, not just the nominal rights. Whatever strategy we come up with, we have, in Argentina at least, a number of almost insurmountable obstacles. I will name three. Bureaucracy. For everything that we want to do, whether it's to buy a pencil or to send someone to give a course at some town or to bring students in, there is such an amount of paperwork, useless paperwork, that it consumes time and money. To bring books into Argentina, which you would think is the obvious job of a library, I have to go through such bureaucracy at customs at a huge cost, which is a leftover of the days of the previous government, which has not been solved, that I have to pay people at customs to help me bring the books out, and sometimes that costs more than the book itself. I'm going to write an essay in my very old age called Bureaucracy Leads to Crime, because I'm committing crimes every day. I'm breaking the law. I'm smuggling books into Argentina in my suitcase, not to pay customs, because it's for the library, and I don't think the library should pay anything to bring a book into the library. I'm forced, for instance, to buy tickets if I need to send someone for to a course, to a training course somewhere. I have to buy them through a state agency that charges me 10 times more than the price that I would get in with Expedia, for instance. So I buy the tickets from Expedia, which I'm not allowed to do. So at some point, I'll be taken into prison for this, and I'll do it gladly. The second obstacle is the unions. I believe strongly in the need for unions. I believe strongly in the defense of the workers. But the unions in Argentina are so corrupt, and I have daily proof of this. They don't defend the workers. They simply try to collect points for themselves and make money out of certain measures. And I have to deal with this every day. I can give you examples later. And thirdly, political obstacles. The Argentinian government today and previously has never been interested in culture. This will not come as a surprise to anyone. So they see the position of director of the National Library as a political position. And when I accepted the position, I said, I will not have my picture taken with any politician. I'm an administrator of the library. I've got nothing to do with politics. But every time we do something, and we've managed to do very many things, some politician will come and have his or her picture taken in front of what we have done, for instance, in the section of the blind, where I got somebody to donate a number of machines that enable a certain electronic reading and so on. The vice president came and had her picture taken. Well, this creates obstacles because donors and people who work as volunteers, perhaps they don't want to be identified with these politicians, and as you can see, it creates a problem. There are laws that need to be changed. The ISBN, for instance, for some bizarre reason, goes to the book chamber and the Publishers Association, not to the National Library. We don't have fair use at all, so we collect the material, but we cannot allow researchers to use the material. So I'm trying to change some of these things, but you can imagine how long a legal process takes in Argentina. Now, what can the strategies be, in spite of all these obstacles, to achieve some of these things of what I would simply call social justice, what I would simply call enabling anyone to make use of these rights. I believe that a library, a museum, an archive can have an exemplary or cautionary role. In the Satyricon, in the first century, the hero in Colpius wanders into a museum and sees the images of the gods in love and identifies with those and says, even the gods have pangs of love and suffer from unfaithfulness. I believe that we can have readers and non-readers alike see in the stories and pictures and everything we have to offer mirrors of their own condition and inklings of how the world can change for the better and be a little happier and a little more just. I don't believe in national plans for the promotion of reading. I have looked at very many, and I don't think any of them work. No one is convinced by a picture of Madonna or Maradona holding a book and saying, I read, you should too. No, that doesn't work. What might work is something that I'm trying to implement. Somebody came in, a teacher with 30 years experience in the slums of Buenos Aires, with a reading project that encourages teachers to become enthusiastic about reading. She discovered something very, very obvious. If you don't like reading, if you're not passionate about reading, you can't teach reading. Kids are not stupid. They're not convinced by somebody who simply says you should read. So she has developed a system that worked in several places. And so I'm trying to extend that first to the province of Buenos Aires and then to the rest of the country. I got UNESCO to give us a large amount of money for this project and to shame the government into putting a little bit of money into the project. So we'll see if it can work. I had a very important experience about 20 years ago with my son when he was a young adolescent. He was a fan of video games. And once he asked me to accompany him to a video arcade. So I said, do we need to buy a ticket? He said, no, you just walk in. So I walked in and there were all these machines and I said, well, do we queue? How do we select what machine? How do we know what games are played in each machine, and et cetera, et cetera? I had to learn the ritual. And as readers, we don't realize up to what point the ritual of reading has to be learned. How to use a book, how to use a library, how to open the book. whether it's digital or physical, there is a ritual to be learned. So I'm trying to implement workshops for teachers so that they can take them to schools to teach how to read. Now, this does not reach the majority of the population. Many kids don't go to school. Many kids are not interested when they're in school because they concentrate on where their next meal will come from. And there is a lack of prestige, not only in Argentina, but in the entire world of the intellectual act. It's not surprising that today an academic discourse, rational, logical, clear, that sets out a contemporary problem, appears much less trustworthy than the grunts and squeals of a president on tweet, because it feels as if it comes from the gut, and therefore it must be sincere. I don't know how the process can be reversed, but the intellectual world has lost that prestige that it had. And we need to restore that confidence in common sense, in grammar, in the logical argument, in dialogue. I will end with this. Going back to Darnton's idea of collecting, and he is much more aware of this than I am, that there will always be too much stuff. A definition of a library can be a place that always exceeds the space you give it. But there is a story by Borges that might be perhaps illuminating. It's a short apocryphal tale. He says that in this empire of the cartographers, map making had developed to such a degree that not only they could map a neighborhood or a city, but the empire itself in a scale to 1:1. And that at the limits of the empire, there remained a few ruins that were the example of that colossal map. I think that we are tending towards that reproduction of the universe in a digital universe. The amount of material that we are collecting will never be everything, but I believe it will approach, at least, if not infinitely, at least something that cannot be measured. And therefore, it becomes essential, something that Darnton and others have mentioned, to find search instruments to be able to be guided. In Alexandria, they realized this. Callimachus, the librarian, began to create his pinakes, his canon, his annotated bibliographies, because he realized that if you said to someone who wanted to consult Greek philosophy, here you have 5,000 volumes, the person would not know where to start. So you have a certain guidance. And so these search tools, we have to be aware, of course, imply censorship, because you can't guide someone to one section and not neglect others. And in that act, involuntary or not, you are leaving things outside. This is a problem. I have no idea what the solution is, and I'm hoping that you librarians will tell me. Thank you.